everybody, from everybody you're in contact with. Sometimes it's what not to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find that in your teaching. You learn something from all your students.
Mm-hmm.
It's a give and take thing.
Do you think that kind of give and take, that where the admiral would either lay something out himself or encourage someone else to lay it out for the group to mull it over, do you think that is typical of commanders at that level, or is he unusual in that respect?
Well, I think it was unusual in that the ease with which you could present an idea to him and feel free to ask a dumb question of him. He was always tolerant of somebody that did not have the experience that he did. He never pretended to have all of the answers. He listened well. He modified his ideas when people had good arguments. If there was just hard-headed opposition, that did not deter him from marching ahead. I guess you have to say that in our group that was initially working on the Seagrams, it was very informal. A lot of the ideas had previously been discussed and sort of started getting coalesced. Some of them grew out of some study recommendations that we had submitted by departing unit commanders that thought their recommendations would never be read, but which we did go over those. Some of them, they were all the way from tactics involved in fighting the war to this range of human considerations, and those were part of it. It was only after we got back into Washington that it became quite formalized then in order to do the tracking and assure that a much wider community knew what the decision was. It took several forms, which are discussed in on watch. I hate to be so vague at how the decisions were made, but we did have, scheduled conferences with the admiral before leaving Saigon, but there was an awful lot of rotating of people at seats with the admiral, and he had walked through the group with us and say, what do you think about so-and-so? Give me your ideas on this. And some of it may have come from somebody that had just talked to him. I don't want to indicate that it was a so-called collegial atmosphere where you talk an issue to death and then everybody goes off and wonders, what the hell did we accomplish? It was a form of discussion, but it came to a decision always, and he would say, let's do a green striper on that. Now, there's another aspect of his philosophy that you want to consider on these early ones, and he mentions this in On Watch. He believed in firing 100 arrows into the air, and if 10 of them hit the target, that was better than having fired 10 of them and only one of them hitting target. The other side of that philosophy was if it's a change, particularly in a personnel policy, and it stands a 50-50 chance of being a good decision, then fly it in the air. And if the screaming is too loud, you know it was a bad decision. If it gets accepted, it was a good decision. He was brave enough to try a new idea, and that's what brought so many of us aboard and willing to work so hard for him, because he listened and he realized that it was a changing world. And he was out in front of all of us. Of course, I certainly don't think we can take a lot of credit for the good ideas.
This almost reminds me in a way of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, in that you have a serious problem, you have a demoralization. In this case, it's within the service and not the nation itself. But in comes a man who recognizes a necessity for something, and even though he might not be exactly certain what that something is, he's willing to experiment. And
I think that's an excellent comparison, one worth drawing more on in your book.
Because I recognize that, because that's one of the things I teach my class, is that Franklin Roosevelt didn't have the New Deal in his mind when he went to Washington, but he did have this conviction that it was necessary to do something. And he says this in his inaugural address, you know, above all, try something, and we'll see through trying it whether or not it works, and we'll keep what works.
I think so, if there was any difference in that, the Admiral did have his concept in mind well before he got to Washington. I think that his discussing the needs of the Navy with Secretary Laird and Secretary Chafee when they came to Vietnam, it is Jeffrey Sands' study, because of the input of other people, said that it was his, the magic of his ACTOV program that was so attractive to them and that got him selected for CNO. I've always contended, based on my debriefs, that it was the recognition that the Admiral was a leader for the Navy that was desperately needed. Mm-hmm. He had the intellect, he had the innovativeness of both personnel changes that were necessary, as well as strategic concepts to face the growing Soviet threat, which at that time he was very aware of from having done the studies that he had done before getting to Vietnam. And you know, here was an officer that grew up in the Pentagon with personnel issues, on the one hand, from having some duties in New Pers, but also with the Cuban Missile Crisis under then Assistant SecDef Paul Nitze. And he had a broad outlook on the world, and he had a philosophy that came from General Marshall, as you remember his quote of that visit with him, and as a young officer being told that if you give the American people the facts, you'll get the support in a time of crisis. And that was the great objection that Admiral Zamoah had to Secretary Kissinger in saying we've got to cut a deal while we can because the American people will never support an all-out effort against the Soviets. So, yes, I agree with what you say about Franklin Roosevelt. I agree it's a good corollary worth drawing. Mm-hmm. But I think, and I'm sure that Franklin Roosevelt had thought of these things in broad terms also, or maybe in more detailed terms before. But the Admiral had been considering these, I think, all his Navy career as seeing things that could be done in a better way.
Right. We shouldn't take the analogy too far, because the Navy is a much more defined environment with procedures that don't exist for a larger...
But the personalities are good, I think, to compare, and the fact that there's a person willing to take a risk.
Mm-hmm.
And
courage.
I think all your great leaders, that's a good point, all your great leaders may well have been in that category. Mm-hmm. And weak leaders vacillate perhaps too long, study the problem to death, and don't get anywhere. Mm-hmm. Mr. Clinton's been criticized for that, certainly in his first term, you know.
Mm-hmm. He doesn't consider the difference between a good decision is 10 seconds.
Arleigh Burke.
Arleigh Burke
said that.
That's right.
Between a good one and a bad one is 10 seconds.
Between a good one and a great one can be 10 seconds.
Mm-hmm. that's an interesting point.
Now this was in combat.
In combat.
Yeah. That's in Dejron 23, the book on him, which Bucks had a chance to read on this trip.
Mm-hmm. Admiral Zamoah returned to Washington and you went with him. Was he at the point planning on keeping you on the staff at that point in a similar role to the ones you already had, or?
The way this grew up, we were doing all this planning the month before we left Saigon, and I think I mentioned that I was, I saw that I, when he asked me, well, I had orders to the Columbus as a SEAL, a guided missile cruiser, every naval officer's great dream, you know, to have his own cruiser command, and this was a newly modernized, converted, modernized guided missile cruiser, only three of the class. I had those orders. His selection came out, his nomination came out, and then we started discussing his tour that would be proper of places he should go. And it evolved into, okay, we'll go back and touch places in the Pacific, which would be natural, and then come west, and so it turned into a trip around the world. Very productive and useful, and both for him and for others who didn't know him to become acquainted with him, and for him to get further ideas on both the grand scale and then the micro scale of the Sea Grant. So he said, would you please then take over the job of organizing the trip and being my executive assistant on that trip, meaning the executive that it was the same thing as a chief of staff role virtually. And it took me about 2 days, and I realized that I could not do both that and be chief of staff in country, still fighting the war and doing the ACTOV work. And I suggested to him that so there'd be some continuity, we have Captain Bill Daniels, W.O. Daniels, who was the J-4, I think, at that time, the N-4, and to be my relief, because he had been aboard about 6 months and had done an outstanding job. Then, when I saw I couldn't be doing both chief of staff and trip planning, I suggested we go ahead and bring him, have him take over as chief of staff. I'd move out of the office into a little cubbyhole and to do the trip planning on, and then if Bill wanted to consult with me, he could get some of the background, and you know, I'd be available that way. And it turned out to be very useful. Bill McDaniels, a very competent officer, and did a good
Daniels
job.
Daniels or McDaniels?
McDaniels.
Okay.
Very good job, and was an excellent relief. And so I went off with him, formed up part of the team. He had some key people that he wanted that I mentioned, like his old academy roommate, Dave Bagley, and then Bill Thompson to come out for Chinfo. And he had just a brief visit from Dave Bagley's brother,
Worth
Bagley, who had a flotilla command at the time and couldn't be detached from that until later when we got back to Washington. And he was a good thinker, a budget planner, a weapons type oriented individual. Then we got some of the others that I've mentioned already, Dave Halpern, and some of the administrative people. He took his aide back at that time, which was our good friend
Mel Stevens.
Mel Stevens. And then some of the administrative people, a wonderful warrant officer, Al Tarter, who was just a tremendously fine flag writer. So those people came back with us. On the way back, when we were in Shanghai, I got the word that I'd been selected for Rear Admiral. This came as a great shock to both the Admiral and myself, because the board was composed of disciples of Tom Moore. And Admiral Zumwalt had apologized to me in advance. He said, I really feel bad because you're going to get your first look by people recognize you as being closely associated with me, and that's going to ruin your chances. Well, it proves that accidents do happen in the system, and I got selected.
And can I interrupt you for a second? That reminds me of something that I wanted to ask you. I read a blurb in one of the sources that I've been looking at, I forget exactly which one, that suggested that once Admiral Zumwalt left Saigon, there was something of a purge of people who had been associated with him. Is that accurate?
I don't think so, and I don't believe in Vietnam. I think what you may have read was in Jeffrey Sands and maybe even Admiral Turner's book, Stansfield Turner's book, that after Admiral Zumwalt left his position as CNO, that there was a purge. And I took great exception with that by citing examples of people who went on to 3 stars, and even Stan Turner himself. He thought he got kicked up or kicked out by being sent as commander-in-chief of Southern Forces Command in NATO, which is, I think, one of the very prestigious jobs, and he was eminently qualified because of his political savvy and knowledge of the system. I don't consider that having been purged to
right.
get 4 stars.
And obviously it didn't hurt you either.
No, I made 3 stars in the recruiting command, but Admiral Zumwalt had been gone almost a year when I got orders to take command of the Surface Forces Pacific Fleet, which I don't know of any finer job I could have asked for as a junior 3-star. And a position that was still in transition and a lot of challenges with it. And although Bob Salzer had done an excellent job of convincing the consolidation, it was not completed until about halfway through my tour. There were surely people who got replaced just as when Admiral Zumwalt came in. He replaced some people that he did not see as well qualified as others who had maybe been around too long. And I'm not talking about personal staff, but out in positions in command. And he was trying to bring in some new blood. Admiral Holloway certainly cannot be accused of being one who would purge have a midnight massacre. He's just not of that nature. He was a gentleman, as was Admiral Zumwalt, did it in an orderly manner. If anything, I did worse than that when I took over the recruiting command because I found some people who absolutely were not producing, who shouldn't have been in the job facing the public, people who were not of the officer qualities that were going to sell the all-volunteer force. So a lot of people, again, have focused on something that any commander might have done.
And because it was team.
Because it was Admiral Zumwalt, it became...
Because he was a lightning rod anyway.
Yeah. You know.
But it seems, maybe it's accurate to say also that it's typical when there's a turnover in command for some key positions to change also, simply because of the infusion of fresh blood, like you mentioned, and also in a position of responsibility like that, you also want to have people who are accustomed to working in your manner of working. Is that... Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there are positions that almost change routinely with
that's right, and that's been recognized through the years by giving the commander the option of having his personal aide, his chief of staff, and things of that, because the gloves got to fit the hand.
Right.
One point that you might want to ask him about, and I think I suggested this and off the record, inquire as to his views of how his policies were carried out in Vietnam when he left, and his degree of satisfaction with the way Admiral Jerry King continued it. The book indicates that there was because of illness, Admiral King did not do a 12-year, or didn't do the full 2-year tour. As a matter of fact, I think he left less than a year. And I think there was, and again, this is off the record list, I don't think that the Admiral was fully satisfied with the performance and had him replaced then by Bob Salzer, who was a veteran of the Riverine War.
He had been First Sea Lord.
First Sea Lord, mm-hmm. as a 4-stripe captain. And I believe that's when Bob Salzer got his 3rd star by going out there. I have to check that. It could be that he went out as 2-star, because I just don't know, don't remember.
So when you return to Washington, and Admiral Zumwalt assumes position of CNO, how long did you remain in Washington before you moved on?
I left in May of 70. I started, it's May of 71. We got back in June of 70, and I left in May of 71.
And were you responsible for NAVDEC that whole time, or
the NADEC?
NADEC,
it was called. Right. Yes, that was my sole responsibility to set that up. And
you were going to tell him that what Bud said when he found you were selected?
Oh, when the word came out that I was selected, he said, "You're going to come back to Washington with me now and help put in these crazy ideas you've been bringing up to me, and all wild ideas or
and
something."
He found you had made
admiral? Yeah.
Yes, I've been, we just got word that I've been selected for it, which means you're a selectee until the president sends a list to the Senate, and then you're a designate, rear admiral designate, until Congress passes on it. And then, let's say you're a rear admiral nominee until the Congress passes on it, and then you're a designate, which means you're going to get it when somebody moves out and a number is available or a billet is created. And that took, I was frocked within a couple of months, I think, after we got back, which means you get to wear the insignia but not the pay. And it was some 6 months probably before I got the pay after we moved back. But he, on the spot, told me that, "Sorry about your cruiser command, old chap, but we don't send admiral selectees to sea in the command of ships, and you're going to come back and put these wild ideas, help me put these wild ideas into effect." And this is, again, his way. He, and we knew that most of them were his ideas, and he was, you know, being humorous, mm-hmm. and we all understood that. But he meant I was coming back to Washington with him. And there were a few others. Now, this entire team that made that trip did not stick around. It was necessary because he had only a lieutenant as a personal aide out there. That's when Jerry Wages was selected back there to be his naval aide and Marine major. Mike Spiro had been in our operations department, and he knew him. But there was a little bit of a lag there, and I forget what it was. I think that's pretty well covered in that opening, not in the opening, but in that chapter in On Watch, where it describes these people and what they had been doing.
Right. Since you were there initially, that initial period when Admiral Zumwalt was CNO, and he comes to Washington and begins to immediately affect these very broad changes, what was your perception of how, from both within Washington itself and from within the Navy itself, what was your feeling at the time as to how that was received, how that was done? What was the feeling within the Navy?
The impression I got that 75% of the people were very enthused about it. There was another group that probably could care one way or the other, but there was some percentage that you just knew they didn't like this idea. There was, first of all, in On Watch, the Admiral makes it very clear that Admiral Moore let him know that he was not his first choice, but he was now the choice for CNO, and he could count on him for support at any time he wanted it. And the Admiral wrote that Tom Moore was good to his word, and he was. There were instances, certainly, they had disagreement on these personnel policies, and indeed of which Admiral Moore supported the CNO within his own coterie of close shipmates and old friends and old admirals in the aviation community. I would debate that it was not total support for Admiral Zumwalt's ideas. We could call it maybe honest professional disagreement, and that's all right, but there was an awful lot of back-channel stuff that made it more difficult, particularly in this race relations hearing in Congress when it came up, that I think could have supported CNO better had they wanted to understand what he was trying to do.
This is at the very top.
Yes.
Admiral Moore and others,
right,
at that level.
And three and four star aviators.
Mm-hmm. Could you give a specific example of how this might happen?
Let me, at one local level, when we first came in, and I was talking to a senior staff member of Admiral Moore's, just trying to get some information, because it had to do with some briefings that we were that had been set up for the Admiral. And I was told, talked down to by this individual as though I were a very much a plebe in the organization, that Admiral Moore was still the Chief of Naval Operations until the given date and time when Admiral Stonewall relieved him, he would remain so. And it was very curt, uncalled for, as though he had been waiting for a chance to put this new wild-eyed tribe from the muddy waters in their place.
This was within Whitten out there in the Pentagon?
This was within the Pentagon. I was still the acting executive director for Admiral Stonewall the first week that after we came into the building for those briefings. And then just to go on those, that's an example of how some of the people reacted. I won't compare it to the crudity of the young lady that, on Bill Clinton's staff who greeted the four-star Air Force general who said good morning to her when he came in the White House, and she said, "I don't speak to military personnel." I don't equate it to that level.
I've heard that story.
It's a little more subtle than that. But I think, you know, these things, again, can be human nature. And just some people are more civil than others. If Moore had gotten his staff together, and maybe he did, I don't know, and this could have just been one individual who said, the new CNO is coming in, we're going to give him every support possible, and all those things. And Tom Moore, overall, as a gentleman, was, ever since then, he has always been very civil to me since his retirement. We have annual flag briefings by the CNO and SECNAV in Washington at the National War College for anybody in the Washington area, flag officers that are retired. And he's always, sometimes he sat next to me voluntarily, always been a gentleman. So there was no grudge that he bore against me, and I don't want to overplay this one point, but there was a thread of that kind of thing through the staff that you knew. His previous staff knew that Admiral Stonewall was not his number one nominee, and it had been less than kept quiet.
Was a lot of this simply because Admiral Stonewall was a service officer, and Moore was perceived, and his friends or clique were perceived?
There was community animosity because there was community competition, mm-hmm. and some of the competition, as always, is good. There are times when it's not healthy, and who can tell what the balance is, but aviation had gone through, since the end of World War, a tremendously bitter battle, which you read about in the Revolt of the Admirals. And I think some of that was a carryover, just as there is for the Marine Corps. They have had to fight for their survival since, you know, the Civil War. And after every major war, when there is a phase down following World War I and II, there were proposals to eliminate them, because why do we need two armies? Then with the burgeoning of land-based air and the corollary of sea-based air from World War II, there were the proponents in the Air Force that we don't need these expensive carriers and all the ships to guard the carriers. Well, all the ships do much more than guard the carrier. But the many arguments that were launched, so there was an ingrained defensive mechanism that they would have preferred to have had another aviation admiral succeed, because they were in quite a contest with Congress, knowing the phase down, which was already underway. The reduction in the budgets were well underway before we got back in 1970 on the out years for the Navy. And there was a great concern that they were not going to get the new production carriers. They were desperately needed, because we did wear out the carriers and the destroyers in World War II, I mean in Korea, Vietnam, because of this lack of maintenance.
Some of which dated to World War II.
Exactly, right? Yes.
Right.
Block obsolescence.
Most of the ships.
And we had not fully recovered from World War II when Korea broke out, by no means. We just kept the best of the breed at that time of the Fletcher and Guerin class destroyers, for example, laid up others that we thought were savable, and then the older classes that, and those that were surveyed as too badly damaged to be worth laying in mothballs were scrapped and sold to other navies. So you're correct, it dated from a period of both World War II and Korea, and a lot of, as I experienced, a very crash program of reactivating a destroyer to get it back to Korea. And then the tightness began again on the budgets, and then Vietnam broke out. And we did not get new construction, we got operating funds for Vietnam, we got money for ammunition. Sometimes we were told, all right, we're going to send another 10,000 men, but you've got to take it out of your hide, meaning you've got to find other pockets of money to pay for it. And generally, that would come out of some of your planned capital programs, and the funds were shifted. But the worst thing was the maintenance funds that had to be drawn down on it, spare parts, stockpiles. And it was pretty well a comparison that at the end of the war, the Marine Corps came out with new equipment. The Navy came out with equipment that had been just run as hard as it could that full period, and practically no money in a capital plan to replace the fleet. New construction was not going into the kinds of ships that we were going to need and the forces we were going to need against the Soviet Union. And therein you get into Project 60 then, and how are we going to face this growing threat? So I think the aviators, I can't criticize them for being concerned. They knew the importance of naval air power. Admiral Sumwalt appreciated the importance of naval air power, and he expended an awful lot of effort getting what was called CVN 70 approved and through the Congress. He cut deals with Admiral Rickover, who later he reneged on, which has been well publicized. But that was the background of that can, you don't condone it, but you can understand it, that took place. And so there was service, inter-service rivalry, and there always will be.
Was any of that opposition from Moore and others in that group based on the perception that Admiral Sumwalt might come in here and shake the system up a little? Or was it just they were trying to protect their turf in terms of aviation?
No, I think they had their fear of him as an action-oriented person from what he had done before when he was in the SecNav's office. He was known as an action-oriented individual that was intelligent. You didn't win a lot of arguments with him unless you had your facts together and your act together, and you're always kind of fearful of an instructor that's going to ask some very penetrating questions that you did not necessarily have the answers to. They knew that.
Sumwalt set up the system analysis department.
Well, give me a chance to get to that. The time in the Secretary's office, and then he spent such a short time in command of the flotilla, but in that period, he created a lot of waves of questions and proposals, and the analysis he did, which showed him we were facing a tremendous challenge that was growing from the Soviet Union. Then he was called back early to set up the Systems Analysis Division, and that had its ripple throughout OPNAV, and they saw it.
Was that Systems Analysis in the sense of McNamara's Systems Analysis, the PBCS?
It was in order to I won't say counter, but to accommodate and to provide the answers that McNamara was asking. McNamara would justify his conclusions based upon system analysis approach. The Admiral saw that that's what the Navy needed. Undoubtedly, it at some stage made that suggestion and suddenly found himself inheriting it. And so he came back and set up that division in OPNAV. It was very effective. And undoubtedly, in that period, there were studies done which the aviators were concerned that there was going to be an increased emphasis in this being able to preserve the sea lines of communications against the Soviet threat that could take money out of the limited pocket and put part of it into, an additional part of it into the surface force modernization. And so his reputation preceded him.
Okay. What programs, from your point of view, that initial time you were there, what programs did you have a role in, and from your perspective, what was Admiral Zumwalt trying to do initially through your branch and through some of the others, in addition to the Z-grants?
I think you can say the capstone of his effort was to have a Navy that would be capable of carrying out its roles and missions in face of an ever-growing formidable threat in the terms of the Soviet Union Navy. None of us can, and I tried to emphasize this yesterday, the worst mistake we can make is to try and guess a potential enemy's intentions. Many bitter lessons that we're not very good at guessing a different culture's intentions. But we must plan on the basis of what is their capability. And the capability was growing by the Soviet Union, and he saw that. So we had to get a Navy reoriented in that direction and get out of the mindset of Southeast Asia, which was one of simply standing off and having freedom of the seas uncontested to carry out our mission there, which was done very well by the Blue Water Navy as well as the Brown Water Navy. There were two aspects, or maybe three, to this. One was the personnel situation, which I think he saw in a much higher priority than a lot of people have given him credit for. But he saw that as the essential ingredient of operating whatever Navy we had. And if we didn't get a handle on that and get the quality people and the training for them, we would never succeed with whatever ships and force we had. The second aspect was to orient the naval force in the direction that would counter the most likely threat. The most likely threat was that of the Soviet Union at the time, who had optimized its Navy to exploit our weaknesses, to be able to cut the lines of communications at the points of their choosing that was optimum for them, for the force they had. And then the third aspect of it, I would say, was the necessary new developments, and within that would be research and development, as well as what quick fixes can we get, what things are on the shelf that we can expedite and get into the fleet that would pose a challenge to the Soviets, that would complicate their jobs. One example for the destroyers, the Fram destroyers, fleet rehabilitation and modernization.
The Admiral Birch program.
Right, Admiral Birch program, to get something sophisticated out there. Those ships we had, they had hangar decks on them. The drone had proven to be not a feasible program. It just had not reached the technological state that it was reliable enough, radio remote control drone, to be able to deliver a torpedo. But we had those. Are there helos currently that we could use that could help with the anti-submarine program by operating off of those? And so this was the kind of look. Are there R&D programs that have shown sufficient progress now that we could make the leap and put them into production sufficiently to do R&D testing that would at least complicate the planning of the Soviet Union? You know, it's kind of like fleet and being. You don't have to go out and actually fight, but if it's back there and a potential threat, you've got to prepare for it, and so that expends effort by the enemy. So those three wedges of the personnel, of the reorientation of the strategy and the shaping and use of the existing fleet, and then what we could do for the fleet of the future on a short-term basis, as soon as possible, with the rest of it being the longer range force, which we now see coming into being.
So equip the fleet to meet that new mission,
right,
is the question, or the issue. Or maybe you could describe the whole process as this is what the Navy must do, and in order to do that, we need this quality of personnel and this quality of technology and equipment.
Right. And you get back to your basic planning concept of you have to define the problem. You start out, what is our basic national objective? How are we going to achieve it? And that means in face of what threats? What's our basic national objective? And then you've got to define that in, as a national defense objectives. Is the world we're going to be living in? What's the threat that you face that would hinder your achievement of those objectives?
And this had always been the purpose of the JSOC, right? To develop that overall picture of what the Navy has to do.
And it's in effect under a different term than JSOP. That's an old term that has gone out of style. And then having defined the threat, what is the force necessary? What is the strategy you're going to use and then to carry it out to achieve the national objectives in the face of that threat? And so what is the force necessary to carry out the strategy to achieve the objectives?
This brings Project 60 to mind. Did you have a role in that?
Only from the NADEC standpoint of trying to help with the monitoring and tracking of it. Set in on many of the initial discussion sessions. I claim no credit for having come up with any of the innovative ideas. The Admiral and Worth Bagley and some other more weapons-oriented people, and certainly the intellect of Stan Turner was brought into effect. He worked on that. Because he had about a 30-day interim period in there where he had been relieved as a SECNAV executive assistant before he went off to take command of the National War, of the Navy War College. There were several people that should get credit for that, and they're better defined elsewhere. But I take no credit for those, but merely for trying to be devil's advocates on some of them, and in the NADEC process of having the presentations made and distilled to the best extent possible, sent down to the Admiral for study and homework, and then sitting in on the decision-making process with the VCNO and the other proper representatives from the warfare communities that should be there.
Well, let me clarify this point then. It seems that from your position almost, during this period at NADEC, that you were, could I accurately describe your role as almost as a troubleshooter for determining how the programs are being implemented and how do you track the success of that implementation? Or
a troubleshooter in the form of highlighting areas that are moving slower than I knew the Admiral wanted them to be. A troubleshooter might be a little more glamorous where maybe even it was administrative. You know, we'd boiled it down to a system, and I won't flatter myself by saying I was his troubleshooter. I fed a lot of information to him, some of which people might not have wanted him to have. But this theory of the Admiral not wanting to be told the truth is the most fallacious thing I've ever heard of. Because that's what he desperately always wanted, because he knew he could find a solution if people would simply let him know what the problem was that they had been unable to solve. And so I did feel it my responsibility to inform him when the team was running into roadblocks, and it had to be highlighted and surfaced, and this was the NADEC process. During that period of the year, I made numerous trips with him as the note taker for action items. Mm-hmm. And some of that was covered in On Watch, particularly our visit to Chile, which was a very, very interesting thing. And there's a lot behind the scenes he didn't write about. But that role, I think, was one of a true executive assistant that was trying to capture the essence of the trip, because he later had to brief up to the president on it, and in a very short period of time.
Like the day they got home.
He reminded me, right after we started the trip, that, and that's where I got this phrase, the half-life of your importance after a trip like this, when you get back to Washington, is about 2 days, and because things change after that. And so we want to be ready the morning that I go in to work after this trip, after return, which happened shortly after midnight, to be able to brief first the Secretary of the Navy and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then be ready to go over and brief the President. The SecDef also was in that. Brief the President, and that meant briefing through Henry Kissinger. And I don't think we ever got past Henry Kissinger on that one. And I'll always remember that. We were in a room about this size in the basement of the White House with a view graph here. Henry over there, Admiral Zumwalt sitting there, screen about that big on the wall, and me on my knees doing view graphs, which we had prepared from the time we'd gotten in on the flight back. We had several very fine people with us on that trip who were experts in their given area of the South Americas on the trip, and my role was to get them together for them to boil down the essence of their visit on paper in their version. I then did rewrites and drafts and trying to, as always, squeeze them down to their essence. Would get approval by the Admiral on the flight back, just almost, you know, 3 pages at a time of some rough script, as well as an outline of what the view graph would be in bullet type forms for presentation, that he would then talk from, which he could do very well without a script, but we had to have a written document to go with it for those who, you know, can't take a board of briefing or who wouldn't be able to attend.